express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art.
And welcome. You're listening to Art on the Air on WVLP 103.1 FM and on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. This is our weekly program covering arts and arts events in Valparaiso and throughout Northwest Indiana. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, right alongside here with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City.
Aloha, everyone.
We're your hosts for Art on the Air. Our theme music you heard is by Billy Foster with a vocal by Renee Foster. Underwriters for Art on the Air are Valparaiso University's Brower Museum, regional art patron Mary Levan, and our landlord, Walt Breidinger of Paragon Investments. If you'd like to find out more about leasing space in this historic building, please give Walt a call, 219-462-5821. I'd like to thank them for their generous support. Thanks to Greg Kovach, WVLP's station manager. Art in the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project grant through South Shore Arts and is part of the National Endowment for the Arts. If you're interested in being a guest or sending us information about your arts, arts-related event, or exhibit, please email us at artontheairwvlp@gmail.com. That's artontheairwvlp@gmail.com. Our program, along with all of our programs, are streaming live at wvlp.org. Art on the Air is rebroadcast on Monday at 5 p.m. Our entire show archive can be heard at our website, breck.com/AOTA. That's breck, BRECH.com/AOTA. You'll also find our detailed arts calendar at breck.com/AOTA. Our shows are carried by Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, every Sunday at 7 p.m., and you can hear them at lakeshorepublicradio.org. And make sure to like us on our Facebook page, Art on the Air, WVLP. Art on the Air is always looking for financial support. We'd like to thank our current supporters. If you're looking to support Art on the Air and, of course, the WVLP station, we'd be happy to become part of the WVLP family anytime. Esther and I especially would invite you to become an underwriter of this program in particular. We have information on our website at breck.com/AOTA. You can find out support information there or at wvlp.org/support. We have underwriter levels at various levels. You can support us. We'll mention you during our show and throughout the WVLP broadcast day. You know, we encourage you to become part of a supporter because we are supported by our listeners. So don't just be a WVLP and Art on the Air listener. Become a supporter or underwriter in whatever amount you're able to do so we continue to bring you great content and this great local programming. And like I say every week, don't give till it hurts. Give till it feels good. And you'll feel so good about supporting Art on the Air and the whole WVLP family. Join the WVLP family today. And on Art in the Air, we're welcome Janet Block, who is the Executive Director for Lebesnik Center for the Arts in Michigan City. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Larry. Thank you. I'm happy to be here. Appreciate it.
Well, we'd like to hear like what's going on at Lebesnik, especially in the near term here, especially now that's the middle of May. So tell us what's going on, especially during the COVID-19 issue going on.
Well, Larry, we're closed to the public right now. Some of our staff is coming in, but most of them are working remotely. And actually, we really wasted no time at all starting to reach out to our community through social media, videos we created, tours of our exhibits online, because actually it was part of our strategic plan that we just finished anyhow. So in a way, it pushed us a little bit quicker into this arena. But we had been preparing in some ways, not for the, you know, the COVID crisis, but we were preparing to reach out more and more through other means so that we could broaden our audience and make sure that we got people who, you know, are further away or for whatever reason are in isolation or just can't make it to the exhibits and to some of the art activities that we hold. So we were fairly flexible, but it's a lot of work.
I'm sure it is. Are you doing like virtual exhibit, like through the gallery or anything? Or do you have anything up in the gallery that you can do a virtual walk, like with Laura explaining things?
Yes, actually, Laura Fosberg, our curator at the Art Center, who is really lively and personable and has been and gives tours throughout our exhibits, usually obviously cannot do that right now. So we have actually, let me count, 7 videos on our website or through our Facebook page that you can access. They're all brief. There's an intro video to the show we have up now called Round Hole Square Peg. And then we have 6 videos that focus on the work of the individual artists in the show. And when you take a tour with Laura, it's really engaging and fun. We have had unbelievably positive comments about how happy people were to see these online, because people who have had the tours bring their friends back and can't wait for the next show to open because she's just really great. So you will be able to access those. And actually, there's 8 videos of the artist, because when I looked at this list last, we had not posted the last 2. So, you know, it's really, you get a great perspective from Laura. You never feel stupid. She always makes the art engaging and fun. And I encourage people to be able to look at the work. There are some great artists in the show, like Phyllis Bramson, who's quite well known as part of the Chicago art scene for decades. There are newer artists like Cody Hudson and Wendy White. There's some spectacular work by Chris Uphues, which is like all done with brush, but it looks just so detailed. So some of these artists live in New York now. They're all from Chicago, but they're up and coming, or they've spent time in Chicago. So I encourage everybody. I think that, you know, they're brief enough that people will not feel like they don't want to approach it. That's one thing that we really figured out here, was that, you know, nobody is going to want to sit and watch a 15-minute video necessarily, but people like, you know, they have time to fit in a couple videos when they can.
I see some of the things you have on the website. You can print a coloring book, other activities, and that Square Peg Round Holes, I think, is the current exhibit running through early June. One of the things is the Lubeznik Art Festival. How's that going to impact? I mean, I know things are up in the air, but how do you project that affecting your art festival?
You know, we're really not sure. I was just on a webinar this morning from the Indiana Arts Commission. They're discussing different ideas. We have over 70 artists who are accepted into the festival in August and would love to be part of it. Really, what we're, you know, my job is really, number one, to keep our safe and the public safe and healthy. So that will be our priority for all decisions. But there are, you know, things we're looking into, possible alternatives, different ways to stay soothed. And these are the things on the webinar that all the institutions, actually not just across Indiana, but across the world, are looking at. And so we're trying to compile best practices. Some of it will be virtual, if we can figure that out. But, you know, what we're looking at as we reopen, which right now we're tentatively thinking could be mid-June, but we are going to follow the guidelines from the scientists and the people who really know the disease. Those are the guidelines that are pertinent to me. So if it's not safe, we will not open. Or if we cannot do it safely, we won't open. So we're taking it a day at a time, but those are the things, you know, we want to be optimistic and think that maybe we can innovate ways that things can take place.
Well, very good. You know, we're about ready to wrap up, Janet. I know you can get a hold of you at lubeznikcenter.org on the net, or you're on Facebook page. And I appreciate you coming on Art in the Air. That's Janet Block, Executive Director for Lubeznik Center. Thank you so much, Janet.
Absolutely. And please, that coloring book is a free downloadable piece. And it was our education director engaged, I think it was 10 different artists in this region.
Thank you, Janet.
Absolutely. Thank you, Larry.
On the south shore of America's Great Lakes, there exists an ecological marvel unlike any place else in the world.
The topography here, it exists no place else on the planet.
This is probably one of the most studied landscapes in America.
Here, 10 distinct ecosystems combine to produce an immense array of life.
There are more than 350 species of birds here, and almost 1,100 species of flowering plants, almost as many plants as in all of Great Britain.
This region would become the birthplace of ecological science in North America, and it would help establish the very roots of the modern environmental movement. Also on this shoreline, the richest men in American history would find a perfect location for their industrial expansion.
Industry brought in prosperity, jobs for the future, but the cost of that was heavy.
The area was deemed to be one of the most polluted in the country.
Literally, there was nothing living in the river.
This collision of nature and industry would inspire ordinary citizens to take action. For over a century, a battle raged over this 45-mile stretch of sandy shore. And out of that battle may emerge a world where community, nature, and industry can endure together. For centuries, the dunes on Lake Michigan's south shore have dramatically shifted with time and the elements. But perhaps the most substantial shift is the change they inspired in the community that calls this area home. Shifting sands on the path to sustainability.
And you just heard an excerpt from Shifting Sands on the Path to Sustainability. That was a great documentary video. You can see that on Lakeshore PBS. And that was one of the people we're pleased to have is Ronna Siegel. She's a director, producer, cinematographer for over 30 years. Her work is aired on PBS, Learning Channel, Discovery Channel. She's award-winning and everything, and we welcome her to Art on the Air. Welcome to our show.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Well, we'd like you to just tell us your personal story, like where you grew up, where you went to school, high school, college, and your kind of your whole journey, how you got from where you were to where you are now.
Oh, okay. Well, I started my life in Hyde Park in Chicago, and then we ended up moving to South Shore. But for high school, I ended up going to a place, an experimental high school in downtown Chicago called Metro, which was called The School Without Walls, and started in February of 1970. And it changed my life, to tell you the truth. And the idea behind it was that you could study anything, and we would go to the... We would go to the Field Museum for studying the sciences. We would go to, the zoo to study zoology. We went to, there was just so many opportunities that we had offered to us, all these different artists and writers, and Studs Terkel, for instance, came to our school all the time. We did have a building that was at 220 South State, and it was around the block from the federal building. And I was 14 years old, and I was taking a photography class, and the Chicago 7 trial was going on, and I was pretty naive back then, and I started taking pictures for my class, and the FBI came out, grabbed me, and brought me into the federal building, and told me that I had to give them my film or my camera, because which I didn't know that Judge Julius Hoffman had issued an edict that nobody could take photographs on the square block of the federal building. Anyway, so that was sort of the start of my journey.
So what did you do? Did you give up the film or the camera?
Well, I gave up the film, unfortunately, but I didn't really have a good choice.
No, you did not have a good choice.
I graduated, and
And then I was interested in music and dance at the time. And I, was taking music theory and jazz dance and ballet and anyway, so in college, and I was taking that, and at Columbia. And I just went with some friends after class to this movie, this Robert Altman movie, and I was sitting in the audience watching this movie called Images. And I was just sort of shocked that it touched me in ways that I hadn't been touched before, that it was about a woman who was schizophrenic, and I don't know, for some reason I felt like I could relate to that. And so I thought, wow, I really want to make movies about this kind of a subject, about women.
Yeah, and real things.
Right, because you see all these movies about men, right?
Right.
So I decided there and then to take a film course, and I just, signed up for my first film course and decided that I liked it, and I went with it. And by that time, I was, 19 or something, and I was like, oh, my God, this is what I want to do for the rest of my life.
You're listening to Art on the Air, WVLP 103.1 FM, and on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. And you studied at New York University, as I understand it?
Oh, yeah. So at first I went to Columbia College and studied, and I graduated from there. And then I went to NYU later in the graduate program. And that was actually where I met a friend of mine, Edith Becker, who we went to... to Alaska together and filmed When the Spill Hit Homer. And that was about the Exxon Valdez oil spill.
And so then what brought you back to
that was the early 90s. I was just trying to get a time frame. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was, I haven't...
Yeah, but I had been doing a lot of filming before that. So, yeah, so I left NYU and... I was homesick for Chicago. I wanted to go back. So I went back to Chicago, and I had actually, before I left to go to NYU, I was working at Fastest Multimedia as a projectionist. And I had also, after I graduated from Columbia, I had a lot of odd jobs. One of them was projecting and the weekend manager at Facet. And, projecting 35 millimeter. And then I got a job at a offbeat second run theater out on the outskirts of Chicago that was, it was not Jackie Chan, it was Bruce Lee movies. And,
well, what a departure from Facet.
Right, well, I was trying to get money however I could. And so that was fascinating. I didn't stay there very long because then I ended up going to NYU. But it was fun while it lasted.
Well, while we're talking about your career, let's just briefly touch on you've done teaching both at filmmaking and video production at Columbia College and at the Center for Television, New Television. Tell us about that.
Right. Well, so at Columbia, I had the opportunity to teach after I got back from NYU. For some reason, somebody brought my name up. I hadn't actually even thought about doing it until somebody said, "Oh, you should teach." And so there I was talking to Tony Loeb, who was the head of the department. And I had just come from watching Witness, the movie Witness, which was amazing to me because it had a very little dialogue. And that was fascinating sort of at the time. But
it was quite emotional and very spare.
Yes. So basically I taught at Columbia Tech 1, Tech 2, and video. And we were still using, I think, 3/4 inch when I was teaching in the video department. And then, but the film, so the first film, I don't know if you've
taken any film courses, but basically it was a silent black and white film. We used a Bolex, and it was a 16-week course, and it was basically, it was like 16 hours a week. I mean, it was incredible. I mean, it may not have been that many, but it was like about 12 hours a week of actual class time. And it was pretty intense. I was like 23 years old or something at the time, and I was like, oh my God, this is crazy. But I brought in some of the techniques that I had learned at NYU. But of course, you know, my basic core was from Columbia College to begin with. And, you know, they had a basic structure to follow, and it was great, and I really loved my students, and we did a lot of fun things, but it was basically all black and white. It was no sound. So that was the first semester. And then the second semester, it was Tech 2, and that was, of course, bringing in color, bringing in sound, and having to take classes. They had to take a production from the beginning and go all the way to the end. And that was the same with my video course as well. But they were much less, you know, it was mostly a group dynamic that went on with the video course. But it was individual with the film courses. And then I taught adults at the Center for New Television, and it was, you know, it was a production course where we learned how to use video equipment, and then they did a little project with it.
Rana, in your history, did you work some film and video? And just tell us a little about film versus video as far as your experience.
Yes, I did. So, yeah, and in the examples that I gave you, Chicago Riverfront, that was shot on film. That was a documentary about the architecture along the Chicago River. So all the beauty shots were done. That was actually a composite. So that was the beauty shots of the city and the architecture were all done with film. But then the interviews were done with video. When the spill hit Homer, we actually shot that with Kartemquin. Do you know Kartemquin? Kartemquin, the company that does a lot of documentaries in Chicago, had a CP16, and they had given it to Chicago filmmakers, and I rented it from Chicago filmmakers to take it with me to Alaska to film when the spill hit Homer. And it was kind of amazing to be up there during that time, because and with film, I mean, it was, you know, you had to change each reel, and you had to have, you know, you had to put it in a bag, and it had to be, you know, completely light tight, and you had to check also for hairs in the gate, which you don't have to do with video, and, you know, so you had to, a magazine was about 12 minutes, so you can imagine what it's like now when you can just roll forever and it doesn't cost anything. But back in those days, some people are still shooting film, but so this is 16 millimeter and it was 12 minutes. And so you were always having to change the film. And I didn't have an assistant with me. It was just me and my friend, as I said, Edith Becker, who's gone on to become a producer, director as well, and she brought her mother to do sound. It was great fun, and we were there for like 2 weeks, and the mosquitoes were incredible, but it was fascinating, and it was kind of horrifying at the same time to see this, you know, the damage that had been done by the Exxon Valdez, and how far it spread out into all the islands, and there were all these people that were trying to clean
right.
The rocks.
Right, there must have been such a learning curve about getting the birds.
Right, and everybody wanted to help and try to fix it, but, you know, there wasn't a lot they could do, really. I mean, it was like one rock at a time.
Yeah, I remember the images of all those birds.
Right.
And that documentary was in 1992, if I remember correctly. When the spill hit Homer.
It might have been 91, because that same year was when I went to Kamchatka
I would love to talk about your sailing just a little bit. So, well, my husband and I, Michael Smith, had a boat called Raven. And it was a choilie, a catch. And we had sailed in the Great Lakes, and we had it moored off of DuSable Harbor, or in DuSable Harbor in Chicago. And we would, you know, sail from Chicago to Michigan and up to Door County, and we had had great times doing that. And
yeah, but you also said, like, when you first met him, you said you wanted to sail around the world. And so, when you said that, did you really think that it was, like, when you said that, did you expect that it was going to happen? I mean, I almost think you would, because of just your school experience. And for most of us, we don't know that it's going to happen.
Basically, what has happened is that I had been brokenhearted, and I was feeling very depressed. And Michael magically came into my life. And I had already been thinking that I wanted to sail, that was something that I really wanted to do before I die, you know, on my bucket list. And so I didn't, you know, I was just putting it out there, basically. And when I met Mike, we sort of met on a magical night. It was a full moon on Halloween, and it was the perfect temperature, and we kind of fell in love immediately. But one of the things that I told him at that point was that I had a dream of sailing around the world. And I didn't know this for several years, but his parents had a boat. And so eventually, we ended up sailing with that boat, and it was a smaller boat. And we got, you know, I learned how to sail on it. And then eventually, we ended up buying our own boat called Raven, and the choilie that was a catch. And we sailed all over the lake and went all these different places. But then 9/11 happened. And, you know, we were both working downtown at the time. Mike was working at the EPA. And I was working in the video department of LaSalle Bank. And, you know, things sort of changed for us at that point. We were, you know, everybody, of course, knows what happened on 9/11, and we started thinking about our future and what we wanted to do. And so at that point, we kind of came up with the idea that we wanted to do our big sail. And so we did, and we sailed from Chicago to through the Great Lakes, down the Erie Canal, along the eastern coast of the United States down to the Bahamas. So we never made it quite as far as we wanted to go, but we had a great time.
So back to your film career, we'd like to kind of move on. Tell us a little about your cinematic background. You've done a whole lot of things with WTTW, I think, Artbeat, but you have a whole laundry list here of great videos that you've been involved with. So give us a kind of a rundown of that.
Well, I've got to say that when I was working with Taggart Siegel, that was probably my first big break. So we started doing the ethnographic documentaries. The first one was about the Hmong shaman, which was called Between Two Worlds. And that documented these Hmong people who had just come from Southeast Asia after the Vietnam War, and they were moving to the Chicago area. They had moved to several other places, but we were focusing on the ones in Chicago. And they had been an animistic, they had believed in animism as their religious belief, and they didn't have a written language until 1950, I understand. So
there were these people that were coming, and they had shamans. And we were interested in documenting their shamanism. And we were working with an anthropologist named Dwight Conkergood, who was studying them. And he was out of Northwestern. And we spent an entire year following this one family and a couple of others. And we showed their rituals and how hard it was for them to fit into, you know, the United States, into the Chicago area, what it was like for them to try to fit in.
You're listening to Art on the Air, WVLP 103.1 FM, and on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM.
How big was the population in the United States? Because I know there's a huge population in Minneapolis area.
Yeah, Minnesota. I think more of them ended up going there. Mm-hmm. But anyway, it was fascinating, and they were beautiful people.
Yes.
And we, you know, Dwight, in this one scene that you show, Dwight, which I didn't know when we were filming it, but that he was blind in one eye. And it turned out that the woman who was the shaman that we show in the film was also blind and in one eye. And so they had a bond that was lovely, and so they did a special ceremony for him. But there was a ceremony for a rescue boy who was, the parents thought that he was dying, and they were working at Burger King, I think, at the time, the father was, and that was, we went to a farm in Oxford where we actually did the ceremony because they had to sacrifice a cow, and That was amazing, and the boy did get well. Wow.
Your next one I saw is Blue Collar and Buddha. That was for the Learning Channel. Tell us a little bit about that one.
Yeah, Blue Collar and Buddha was about a Buddhist temple, a Laotian Buddhist temple in Rockford, Illinois, that... these people also were in the United States because of the war and the Vietnam War and the Laotian War. And they were living in Rockford, and they had a Buddhist temple, and somebody tried to bomb the temple. They put a pipe bomb in the temple. And so we went there, and we were trying to discover, you know, talk about these people and their lives, but also try to find out who it was who actually did the crime. Unfortunately, we never were able to, but we do show different aspects of the community. It had been a furniture-making community that had lost its economy, and so there was a tension between the people who had lived there for years and these newcomers, and you know, and everybody was just trying to get by, but there was a lot of hate that had developed, and so there was one amazing scene. Well, there were several, but one amazing scene was there was a Civil War battle going on in this park, I guess it was, and we did an interview with the mayor of the town, and with the Civil War reenactment going on behind them.
And then you moved on to, I think it was narrated by Barbara Jordan. You had a piece called From the Bottom Up. Tell us about that, the story of communities in Chicago.
Yeah, well, we shot that all around. That was Jeff Fitz was the director. And that was, we shot in New York. We shot in Brownsville, Texas, and we shot in Embarrass, Minnesota, and then we went and we interviewed. Well, we didn't interview Barbara Jordan, but she does the opening, and it was personally for me it was fantastic to meet Barbara Jordan, the acclaimed politician who just had the most amazing voice. And she was teaching basically at the University of Texas at the time in Austin. And so we went down there and did that with her. And so that was early on. That was, I forget the year for that, but that was fascinating in some ways. It was broadcast nationally, and we shot that on, from the bottom up, 1988. Yeah, so we showed all these different communities that were figuring out ways in which they could, without, getting help from Washington, basically, from Washington, D.C., that they were trying to figure out ways to revive their economies. Because there was a recession at the time, and they were all struggling. And so, and then there was the one, Jack Kemp, I think, had a, there was a, Jack Kemp came to town, and that might have been one of the other examples that we showed. They gave him a bus tour, some of the local housing people. That was interesting, too.
Now, we did talk about your Chicago Riverfront one, but after that you did was one called The Long Road Home that you were a videographer for, about a Guatemalan refugee. Tell us a little about that one.
Well, that's interesting. I went with Andrea Leland, who was the director for that, and we were following a young boy who was from Guatemala, and his relatives lived in the refugee camp in Mexico, and they had been fleeing Guatemala. They were indigenous people, Mayan people, and they had fled Guatemala because of the fascist dictator, and they had basically the term disappearing, as far as I understand, was coined because of Guatemala, because so many people that were Mayan were being disappeared and killed. And so they were fleeing from that. And so he and his family had been in the Mayan refugee camps that were in Mexico, in Chiapas. And we found him in Chicago. I don't really remember exactly why he was in Chicago, but the director decided that we should follow him in this refugee camp. And it was fascinating. I mean, we went down there, and they were building their own homes down there, and they had meetings, and it was quite democratic and quite organized. And the Mexican government was actually really helping a lot with support. I'm not sure how much, but financially possibly, but they at least gave them the land to try to rebuild the community there. And anyway.
And then I see you did one in the previous Soviet Union about the coup there called Kamchatka, the land of the revolution rainbow.
Kamchatka, the land of the revolution rainbow. So that was quite historic for me, because I'd always wanted to walk across the Bering Strait, and in my mind, I don't know if I ever really wanted to do it, but when it was frozen over.
Right. Well, it's very romantic when you think about it.
But anyway, so, and my grandfather he came from the Ukraine, but back then Ukraine was part of the Soviet Union. So I'd always had these ties, I felt personally connected to Russia. So we went to Alaska, we changed planes. I was bringing a Betacam, and back then you had these mega batteries that you would have on the back of a beta cam. I had a tripod. I didn't have an assistant. And I had three boxes of beta cam tapes, which were like bigger than shoe boxes, basically. And then I had a monitor, and I had sound gear, and I had the camera and the tripod. And so I had these two giant bags that I was carrying with me. So I went with this group, this REI group, that they wanted to create some kind of a treaty with Russia, with the Soviet Union, so that they could bring American tourists, fishermen, to the Kamchatka, because they had heard that it was this amazing wilderness. And so they were there on a fact-finding tour. They wanted to see what it was like there and see if it really was what everybody had said it was, if it was this amazing wild. So we left Alaska. We left from Anchorage, and we ended up taking Alaskan Airlines. I think it was one of the first airlines to fly into. It wasn't the first, but it was early when they were first starting to figure out how to fly into the Soviet Union. And we stopped down at after like, I forget how long, 10 hours or so, maybe more, I can't remember, but many hours. We touched down in this place called Anandar, and to refuel so that we could go to Kamchatka, which was south of there. And it turned out that I believe it was like a prison camp, and there were soldiers that were guarding us so that we wouldn't go onto the tarmac just for the fueling. And then we took off and we went south. And by the time we got to, I think we were in the air, or we were traveling for almost 24 hours, but we ended up going to this town called Khabarovsk, which was not where we were supposed to go. We were supposed to go to Petropavlovsk, and which is actually a shipping and military town on the peninsula. And this place that we ended up was across from China on the Amur River is what separated them. And they wouldn't let us out of the airport, and they said that we would have to go back to the United States. They weren't going to actually let us stay in the Soviet Union. And our team leader was like, there's no way. We're staying. We just traveled all this way to get it. We're going to be staying here. And somehow, I don't know, he managed to bribe them, I guess, is what happened. And they allowed us to stay, and then we got a plane the next day to go to Petropavlovsk. And from there, we were just in Aeroflot planes. And so it was an Aeroflot helicopter, and we would pile in, and then we would go into the wilderness, and then they put us on a raft, and it was really quite beautiful, which you can see from the video if you show it. I don't know if you're going to, but... And there were bears, and they told us how to walk around without getting eaten by a bear. And it was, 2 weeks of, it was just an amazing wilderness. We had our own cook with us, and thank goodness we did, because when Gorbachev was taken hostage, all of the people, all of our minders who had been, making sure that we didn't talk to the Soviet people or get into things that we shouldn't have gotten into, they all left because they did not want to be associated with the Americans. So we were stuck in the wilderness with this cook who made like amazing crepes with these fresh strawberries. I mean, it was incredible. The food was incredible. And we, would go in the local spring, and of course there's vodka, I have to say. And you can't just drink it. You can't just sip the vodka. You have to drink the whole glass at one time.
So it was It was just you and the cook. There were no other.
And the fisher people.
And the fisher people. Okay.
Yeah, I was. Yeah. So we were all together. All the Americans were together with the cook. All the people who were our minders, the people who made sure that we didn't talk to anybody or do anything that we weren't supposed to
do. Take any pictures that might...
Right. Everybody else left. They took the helicopter. They left. They didn't tell us where they were going.
You're listening to Art on the Air, WVLP 103.1 FM, and on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM.
One day we find out, you know, we found out the whole story because we were actually not far from, I guess somebody decided to take a hike and see that we were not far from a local farmhouse, and they had a shortwave radio. And so we were able to find out what had happened, actually. And so finally our people came back and got us. But by the time we got back to Petropavlovsk, it was chaos in the airport, and they didn't have any planes, and it was packed with people trying to, I don't know who these people were, or where they were coming from, or where they were going, but it was like, it reminded me of the chaos of like when people were leaving Vietnam, when the Americans were leaving Vietnam. It just was really, it was just chaos. And I was dragging these two giant bags, which is why I brought them up in the first place. All the way. We had to go to the other side. We waited all day to get a plane. And finally, I guess somebody, you know, our leader finally gave them enough money and bribed them. And we finally were able to get on a plane that was at the other end of the airport. We walked all the way with these bags. And we got on the plane, and the plane, it felt like, as it took off, it felt like the plane was going to fall apart. Like all the rivets were going to come out of it. The seats didn't work. I mean, this is like one that they found in a junk heap, and they decided that they would put us on it.
I've been on small planes that sound like that.
Said, okay, I'm just going to close my eyes and hope for the best.
Well, Rana, I'd like to move on. You've got a whole inventory of wonderful videos and film, but you started moving into producing and directing in, like, it looks like around 2000 for Artbeat and LaSalle Video. Tell us a little bit about that.
Okay, let's see. So that would be, right. Well, that was when, so I did the On the Shoulders of Giants, and I was doing these small films when I was at the LaSalle Video Studio. And they were great. I mean, the one about Linkin Park was, it was great to go behind the scenes at the zoo, and I always loved Linkin Park, and so that was wonderful. And then,
But then at some point you, also do films on different artists and the things they do as well, not just, and that's how, you know,
right. Well, then I was working with at Artbeat Chicago, and I did a few different things. And one of them was nominated for an Emmy, a local Emmy, Painting the Town, which was about a local local muralist. Yeah, it was great fun showing how he did it, and I spent the summer with him, following him.
Yeah, he's so talented.
Yeah, that was great fun. And well, and I had actually, you know, then there was, I did Linkin Park, A Plan for the Future, which was earlier. That was in 1988. So I had already started doing them. And then in 1990, I did Sunrise, which is when I was working with Maya Romanoff, who,
right,
you know, created this work of art that was on the, a tie-dyed work of art on the,
Sometimes.
In the old Sometimes building.
So, Rana,
and then there
go ahead. No, go ahead. I thought you were talking.
No, go ahead.
Okay, so, I actually want to hear about the rest of the artists. But I just wanted to say, I also, like, I admire everything you do, and I'm so interested also in you talking about the process of choosing your next project, or do they choose you? And how many projects do you work on concurrently?
Oh, well, sometimes they find me, and sometimes I find them. So Sunrise, that's sort of, I was working with a guy named Brian Gale, and Maya Romanoff called him up, and he said, oh, you want to do this project? And we're like, yeah, we do. And the Linkin Park, A Plan for the Future, was something that was actually developed because of the film that I made about the Chicago architecture. They came to me and they asked me if I would do a video project surrounding the same sort of thing, but about Linkin Park, the actual park. So it was, you know, basically at the Center for New Television, what I did was I set it up so that we filmed in the spring, fall, winter, and summer. So it was four classes in an entire year. So we were working on getting the footage. And then the next class was about editing it. And so then we put it all together. And so that's kind of what Linkin Park, A Plan for the Future was. Let's see. And then there was, Sunshine. Should we get to Virginia?
Yeah, Virginia's great.
So Virginia, we had been doing our sailing, and I thought, I have got to get back into filmmaking, because if I don't, I could just give it up, because, you know, the technology was changing, and I had to get, you know, into learning the new the HD equipment. And so I thought, okay, a lot of people I know had MS, multiple sclerosis, in my life. And a lot of people had multiple sclerosis, but I wanted to do something with artists. And so I was reading, what's the name of that paper? The Beecher. I was reading The Beecher, and Virginia had a front page article about her. And I thought, oh, wow. Well, I guess what I didn't talk about, let me back up a little bit. We had moved to Indiana because my husband is actually from here and grew up on the property that we're living on now. And so once we finished sailing, we moved to Indiana. And so that was how I found out about the Beecher, the magazine. And I saw Virginia had written this article, and I thought, I want to make a film about her. And so I called her up, and she was like, oh, yeah, that sounds great. So then we started, and it took several years, but we eventually ended up getting it, and it was wonderful, and I love her work, and she was just such a great person, and so it became very personal to me. And so, yeah, but getting back to who I knew, when I was a young child, my mom was a dancer, and she had taken from a guy in Chicago called Charlie Bachman, and he had MS. And I ended up taking dance classes with him myself as I was about 8 to about 12 or something. And he was a wonderful man, and it was just so painful, you know, when he passed. And so I thought, okay, this would be sort of my giving back to him, to talk about this woman who has MS, who's an artist, and
has a vibrant career. I mean, she's
and it
well.
Had a vibrant career, and she just, I mean, I couldn't believe how much energy she had.
Yeah.
I mean, she had more energy than most, you know, 20-year-olds.
Rona, I'd like to move us on because we're almost out of time. Just briefly about Shifting Sands, and tell us a little bit about that, the Path to Sustainability. That was in 2016, and just kind of wrap us up with that.
Well, so I'll tell you how I got involved with that. So I actually, because I went to Metro, well, I ended up going to high school with Lee Botts' son. And Lee Botts was originally from Hyde Park and from Chicago, although she hailed from Oklahoma originally. But her children had grown up in Hyde Park. And so I knew her because of that, and I knew her, you know, because of her kids. And I always admired her greatly. I mean, she just was, you know, this amazing environmentalist.
Very much so.
And so she moved out here to Indiana and started, you know, working with Save the Dunes and you know,
founded
creating
the Michigan Federation.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I knew that she was wanting to do a movie, so I ended up getting in touch with her, and from there, we brought in Patricia Wisniewski, who ended up directing it, and I was shooting it, and then Tom Desch edited it, and then we all produced it, and it was a labor of love, as we like to say. And it was many years that we spent making it. And, you know, unfortunately, so many of those people have passed now. Lee, Herb Reed, and others. It's, you know, it's sad, but they were all very old to begin with. But just in the last year or so, they've been passing. A lot of them have.
Well, it's a major work, and we appreciate it, the Shifting Sands on the Path to Sustainability. I know if you are a member of PBS Passport, especially for Lakeshore PBS, you can watch that right now on the Passport if you are a member, and you can see that along with the other work. Rona, thank you so much for being on our show, Art on the Air, and we appreciate this in-depth interview with you, and very fascinating.
Thank you so much. It was great talking to you both.
You are so amazing, Rana.
And we'd like to thank our guests today for being on Art in the Air, which is heard every Friday at 11 a.m., rebroadcast Monday at 5 p.m., and Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. Your hosts are Larry Breckner and Esther Golden. Thanks again to Greg Kovach, WVLP's station manager. Underwriters for Art in the Air are Valparaiso University's Brower Museum and Walt Breininger of Paragon Investments. Also, Mary Levan is our art patron supporter. Art in the Air is supported by the Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant and the National Endowment for the Arts. If you're interested in being a guest or send us information about your arts-related event, exhibit, please email us at artontheair@gmail.com. That's artontheair@gmail.com. See you right here next week, 103.1 FM and 89.1 FM, Art on the Air.
Aloha, everyone. Have a splendid week.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the Air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the Air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.